Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com with you on the 9th of March, 2015. And today we are talking once again to Dr. Timothy Ball, the author of The Deliberate Corruption of Climate Science. And of course, his website is at drtimball.com. That's drtimball.com, which will be linked up in the show notes, as well as our previous conversation, which we had back in January on geography, politics, and cognition. A particularly fascinating conversation from my perspective, connecting a lot of my various research interests in a very interesting jam-packed hour plus conversation. So if you haven't listened to that one yet, please do so. And today we're going to be picking up, I think, from where we almost left off last time, where you were just talking, Dr. Ball, about the idea of rainfall patterns in the interior Asian basins and how that has shaped much of European history. And I want to pick up from that idea of how geography and climate and things of this nature really do shape a human history and have done so in the past and continue to do so too today. Obviously, a very large topic with a lot to explore. So why don't we get right into it, talking about some of the people who have talked about this in the past?
Well, the idea we were talking about was the pulse of Asia. And this was the idea that the interior basins of Asia, which are basically occupied by the Mongolian peoples, their populations fluctuated with the rainfall pattern, a 300-year rainfall pattern. And what you got was as the grasslands became more productive, the number of horses they could sustain, number of people, and of course then they would spread out into Europe and Asia. And a lot of the names that you hear in today's world were central to that, the Goths, the Ostrogoths, the Visigoths. And of course, one of the groups that was so critical to that pulse of Asia, as it was called, were the Kurds. The people of the Kurdish people, of course, were the ones that were seen as most threatening because they, throughout history, had invaded into Western Europe and into Southern Asia. And so after the First World War, those nations that had been threatened by them convinced the powers that be, particularly Britain, that the Kurds should be divided up between three different nations. And, of course, that was the way the Brits controlled, was divide and conquer. But on a larger scale, we can start with the idea that in order to have a civilization, and of course civil or civic means city, you need to have a surplus food supply. And under the when you got just hunter-gatherer, it was purely a matter of survival. Now, people expanded their ability to survive in areas that were marginal with the use of fire. And fire, of course, allowed them to live in regions they wouldn't normally live, but it also allowed them to eat foodstuffs that they normally couldn't digest, but also then clothing. But on a larger scale, once you switched from hunter-gatherer, about 10,000 years ago, you get into pastoral agriculture, and you the real switch comes in what's now what's called the Fertile Crescent, which essentially stretches through Iraq and that part of the world. People started to harvest grains and then save the seeds and plant the seeds. In other words, they got into agriculture as we know it today. And it always bothered me, or not bothered me, but it always made me wonder, why would they do that? Because the hunter-gatherer diet, by our own today's measures, was the ideal diet. It had between 27 and 28 different foodstuffs, berries, nuts, fruits, and so on, and grains. And then you got a small amount of meat with it. We gave that up, and we went to sedentary agriculture, which limited the basic foodstuffs to four or five basic foods. Cereal grains and potatoes and rice, of course, were critical to this. And you were also stuck in one place. With hunter-gatherer, if you had a drought in a region, you simply moved to a wetter region. You migrated. And there's all sorts of interesting aspects of that that we can see in history, human history. For example, the migration out of Africa as the Sahara Desert gets increased rainfall, and the people could migrate up into Europe and Asia. So the idea of the ability to, or the movement that hunter-gatherer gave you, that was lost. You were suddenly stuck in one place. But what happened with sedentary agriculture, of course, came the first cities, the first communities. And what became important was the storage of grain, the control of the food supply. And that, of course, is where we are today with sedentary agriculture. But as I said, the idea that we reduced the amount of foodstuffs made ourselves then at the whim of the weather. Because even today's modern farmers, with all the technology and all the things they have, if they don't get the rain or the heat, they don't get a crop. And it puzzled me as to why this would happen. I think that the answer is security of supply. That is that we were prepared to give up a diverse foodstuffs in order to have a security of supply. But of course, once we got into cities, then you get into civilization, and we see that with the early civilizations through that part of the world, some of the oldest communities like Jericho and places like this. And it's interesting when you look at some of the writings, if you want to call it that, on the tombs of the Egyptian pharaohs, they all brag about their ability to produce enough food to see them through periods of drought, periods when the Nile River dried up, that they were able to keep their people alive through these dry periods. And of course, what that has come down to today is that farmers never say, oh, you never get back-to-back droughts. It's not true. They say it because they know that if you get back-to-back drought, you're in trouble. You're simply not going to survive. And so all of these things then manifested in today's world. You also see it, by the way, in our earliest attempts to control the weather, because beyond fire and clothing, rain dances were amongst the earliest. Amongst the Maya, the Aztec, bloodletting ceremonies of the leaders in order to make sure that the drought cycles were broken and the rains came is very fundamental to early civilization. And of course, then what you also get in the Fertile Crescent, that starting about 9,000 years ago, the sedentary agriculture started, but as we got into a much warmer period called the Holocene Optimum, and what happened was that Fertile Crescent started to dry up, and so the introduction of irrigation agriculture started very, very early in human history. But beyond all of that, once you've got cities and civilizations, of course, the civilization grows with the increase of food production. Surplus food is surplus time. And in that surplus time, you can create empires. You can create all sorts of civilizations of different forms. They tend to vary or fluctuate between civilizations where you're building very large structures. I mean, to build pyramids, you have to have people that are being fed by other people. There has to be surplus food for that. The other form of civilization that you get into is the development of intellectual advance. Now, one of the earliest of these, of course, was the Greek miracle, where Greece, where if you go there today, it's a very dry, arid region. But between about 700 BC and 400 BC, that part of the world became quite wet, and food production increased. And then you got the Greek miracle developing because of people being able to produce enough food to allow other people to sit and think and develop ideas. And of course, this idea reached its current ultimate in the United States. Because in the U.S., after the war, where they were producing almost 60% of the total foodstuffs produced in the war, in the world, I should say, you now have America where only 2% of the population, according to their census data, are actually listed as farmers as a profession. There are about 12 to 16% that are identified as rural, who are supporting those farmers in that food production. But the other 98%, or 80% or more, are living in the cities. And what you see going on in China right now, and India, China particularly, this massive migration of people from the producing the food into the cities and the growth of the cities. And China is effectively going through, in about 40 to 60 years, what it took Western Europe and America included in that, about 400 years to evolve. And people forget that before you had an industrial revolution, you had an agricultural revolution, and the development of technologies to increase food production, crop rotations, and all sorts of other things. So that's essential to understanding the dynamics of the geography, the land's ability to support people and produce foodstuffs to create that surplus time. Invariably, what happens when you look at history, and one of the historians particularly that looked at this cycle of civilizations was Arnold Toynbee, the British historian, and others, Brodel, the French historian, Emmanuel Leroy Ladurie, people like these who've looked at the cycle of civilizations, that the rainfall changes, the ability to produce food increases, surplus food is created, the civilization grows, but then people living in the cities are detached from the food production process. But the problems are already starting to show up. The rainfall pattern is starting to change again. The soil erosion is starting. The salinity of the soils are increasing, so the soil is not as productive. And by the time the people in the city realize what's happening, it's too late, and the civilization collapses in on itself. And you could see this in Egypt, for example, where the pharaonic periods are about 300 years, and then another one comes in, and it goes on for thousands of years. And so that cycle, and it's one of the things that frustrates me today, James, with the IPCC, the United Nations, looking at only temperature, when the real issue in human history and food production is the precipitation. What's going to happen with the precipitation patterns? Now, America, of course, happens to occupy, it's the largest country, the parts of China are similar, but America, from 30 degrees of latitude to 50 degrees of latitude, that is the most fertile and productive for sedentary agricultural region in the world. So once America got started and the food production capability took off, it just grew in leaps and bounds. And in fact, you've got now the bizarre situation. It started with the Bush regime. They were paying farmers not to produce food in order to maintain the prices. That's how proficient America became. And of course, the question is, what's going on the farms now? How much longer can the 2% without the support, without the political clout, maintain the situation? Now, on top of that, of course, what you've got is this development of controlling the land, and controlling territory becomes important. We talked about it briefly last time with the idea that a state was an organic being, and this was the taking social Darwinism and applying it to the nation state. And Friedrich Ratzel, the German geographer, came up with the term anthropogeography, and he was the guy that said the state is an organism, and the more powerful states will grow at the expense of the weaker states around it. But as we developed through that, then we got into these superpowers. Some states became so large that they were dominating huge regions of the world. And we saw that with the superpower of America. We saw it with Russia under Catherine the Great and so on, and pushing out into the marginal regions. And what you got happening in Europe was the nation states of Europe in the 19th century started to, they were producing more foodstuffs. But they, once they got into industrial, they didn't have the resources that they needed. And so they started spreading around the world looking for resources to feed these empires. And, of course, that then led you into the determination to control large areas of the world. And one of the earliest examples of it was Elizabeth I, interestingly enough. She had a professor by the name of John Dee, and he was called the Queen Sorcerer by some people. But Dee drew a map in around 1520 or so, looking down on the North Pole of the Arctic Ocean and Russia and Britain and North America, as it was. And he determined that where Spain and France were powers occupying the middle latitudes and across in the Americas, that for Britain, they could control both the whole of the Northern Hemisphere if they could control the Northwest Passage. So if they could control, find the western end, or eastern end, I should say, and of course Elizabeth sent out expeditions with Frobisher and people like this, but very few people know that Elizabeth sent Francis Drake out. Now, it was done as part of his trip around the world, but what was more important to Elizabeth was that Drake was secretly ordered by her to find the Northwest Passage from the western side of America. And there's a very good book that I happen to be able to help the author with called Sir Francis Drake's Secret Voyages. And Drake sailed up the west coast of North America, and we know how much he did because when he got back from a trip around the world, Elizabeth immediately went on board his ship. She ordered him not to land in Plymouth, go to London. She got on board, grabbed his charts and logs, and swore him to secrecy and said, look, we'll give you a medal for finding your way around the world. But Drake wanted to get the medal for finding what he believed was the western end of the Northwest Passage. And Elizabeth said, no, you can't talk about that. Well, Drake, being the sort of renegade that he was, took off to Europe and met up with the then world map maker, Ortelius. And suddenly, within 2 months of Drake arriving, Ortelius draws a map of the world in which the west coast of North America is shifted 60 degrees of longitude west to its actual position, and islands appear on the west coast, which we now know are Vancouver Island and the Queen Charlotte Islands and so on. But it's interesting because as a child growing up in Britain, I learned about the search for the Northwest Passage, but I never was told about Drake's voyages to the western side of it. So this was an example of this growth for empire, the growth for resources, and of course, out of that came things like the Hudson Bay Company, the Dutch East India Company. These were attempts to establish a resource base and control large regions of the world. Now, we jump ahead a little bit here and kind of going through it quickly to sketch out the ideas. But Britain achieved its control. And I know everybody knows the comment about the sun never set on the British Empire. And some other wag said that was because you couldn't trust the English in the dark. But the idea was, of course, that Britain then controlled the world effectively. Now, how did they do that? Well, it was done through the Navy. The Navy was critical to everything. And it was under Charles II and the diarer, the guy who kept the diaries, Samuel Pepys, And that whole, and Charles II, of course, was the one that gave the charter to the Hudson Bay Company. And Pepys was the one that set up the bureaucracy, that set up the British Navy. Without that, of course, the British Empire could not have controlled the world as much as it did. And the whole idea of sea power was summarized in about 1890 in a superb book by Arthur Mahan, M-A-H-A-N, and it's the sea power, how sea power allowed the British Empire to control the world. Well, as the British Empire started to decline, with the death of Victoria in 1901, the British Empire was starting to lose power. A whole new theory evolved. And it came about, as so many of these things do, with an academic sitting down, and academics either create ideas or hypotheses by induction or deduction. That is, that they come up with a theory and then they go and try and find facts to support their theory, or they take facts and try to create a theory to explain the facts. And so sitting in his office at Oxford University was Sir Halford Mackinder. And Mackinder's looking at the map of the world on his wall, and of course it's the standard Mercator map, and it's the physical map with the plains and the lowlands in green and the mountains in brown and so on. And he says to himself, okay, if I was going to control the world, what area would I need to control the world? And he decided that the largest plain in the world was the heartland, what he called the heartland. Now, that is effectively the 500 to 700 mile radius around Moscow. Now, of course, Moscow was created by the Vikings, who also were spreading out because around 900 to 1000 AD, the climate warmed up, the Scandinavian countries started producing more food. There was an explosion of population, and people started to spread out looking for new land. And of course, Eric the Red, who was wanted for murder, in fact, convicted of murder, he didn't go east because all the other Vikings were sailing into the whole area of Russia. So his father said, go west. There's nobody going that way. And of course, he ends up in Landsomed or in Greenland and Iceland and so on. But the Mackinder looks at his map and said, okay, if you control that area of that, that would be a massive agricultural region, but it's a large plain. But more important, it was defended naturally because all around it, you had physical barriers to invasion. You had the Himalaya Mountains across the bottom of Asia or of Russia. You had the mountains through in Europe and into the Alps and so on, right out to the western coast. Then in Scandinavia, you had the Scandinavian mountains, and then of course to the north, it was totally ice jammed up year round. And in fact, one of the things that has created what historians talk about of Slavic paranoia is the fact that you've got Russia, the largest country in the world, with essentially the most unusable, at least accessible coastline of any country. It's a great paradox. By the way, Elizabeth I was also sending explorations around the top of Russia. They have found archaeological sites of Elizabethan expeditions and ships and crews that perished trying to get around the top of Russia. But, of course, the ice conditions are such that it just simply wasn't possible. So Mackinder saw this heartland area, and he called it the World Island. So he said, if you control that World Island, you can control the world. And that idea became Mackinder's heartland theory, And it became the basis. Now, of course, one of the people that had experimented with that was Napoleon. Napoleon wanted to get to Moscow. That was his whole objective. And that's tied in with that same thinking that Mackinder had developed.
And I should note, just for the Corbett Report listeners, that that you may be familiar with Mackinder and the Heartland thesis, because it was featured quite prominently in my lecture on the Gladio B series, talking about how Eurasia is still a very important, very pivotal region of the world for geographic control. And there are people like Zbigniew Brzezinski who still harken back to Mackinder in this idea of the Heartland theory.
Yep.
So this brings us, of course, just a toehold into the 20th century, and we'll have to extend it out from here, but unfortunately, because of time constraints, I am going to have to start wrapping up this conversation, unfortunately, but there's obviously, we'll have to bring this up to the 21st century in the next conversation. But before we do so, you've raised some extremely important thoughts here today, which I hope will give people the sort of necessary perspective, a little bit of humility, that humans sometimes think they are absolute determiners of events, but often we are determined by things like geography and climate in ways that we don't fully appreciate unless we sit back and look at the full scope of history. However, having said that, this does run the risk, perhaps, of becoming a type of environmental determinism along the lines of something like a Jared Diamond, Guns, Germs, and Steel, that it could not have been any other way. Is that really sort of the underlying idea that we're working from here, or is there a kind of combination of individuals and events and circumstances that combine to make the reality that we've seen?
It's a combination of things. The idea of two things that developed parallel to what I'm talking about were people like Ellsworth Huntington, who was the guy that came up with that Pulse of Asia theory. He was talking about environmental determinism and climatic determinism, and those ideas were developing parallel with this. In other words, they were looking at regions that could support populations and regions that couldn't. Ellen Semple Churchill is another one. And so these ideas of climatic and environmental determinism were developing parallel with this. Now, where we can end today's program with this is that the idea of climatic and environmental determinism, which people like Confucius had looked at, Montesquieu had looked at, and others, came to a crashing halt academically because Hitler took those ideas and said, look, people are environmentally or climatically determined, and people in cold climates are aggressive and intelligent, and people in hot climates are dumb and stupid and lazy. In other words, he applied a whole racial component to it, so that after the Second World War, no academic would even mention the word determinism, geographic, or environmental, or climatic determinism. But obviously, they threw the baby out with the bathwater, because clearly there are environmental and climatic limits to what animals and people can do.
There clearly are. And it is, as I say, this is a fascinating discussion. I am literally on the edge of my seat. So I am very much looking forward to our next conversation, where we continue to develop these ideas. And I will only let you go today on the condition that you come back perhaps a month from now to continue this conversation.
Very happy. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about these
Excellent.
Things.
All right. Once again, let's direct people to drtimball.com, drtimball.com, where they can find your Deliberate Corruption of Climate Science book, as well as your various blog posts and writings. Any other resources you'd like to direct people to today?
No, I think that's enough to get started.
It is a start on a very, very fascinating and very big topic. So my hat's off to you. Obviously, you are a seasoned lecturer, so I understand that you've managed to pack a lot of info into today's podcast. So thank you so much for your time again today.
Thank you.